Secular campuses are being transformed, but the students need your help. Last year, students at 41 secular universities asked to start TI chapters. Only 10 could be funded. The rest are still waiting. Please, give a student the yes they've been praying for. They're ready, but they can't share the truth without you. Your gift before September 15th can launch a new TI chapter and change lives. Go to ThomisticInstitute.org/donate or use the link in this episode to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I'm going to begin my talk on personal relationships with AI. I want to deal today with apparently personal AI, of which the chief example that we're all familiar with is ChatGPT. ChatGPT was released a few years ago and has gone through several iterations, the most famous of which would be the version integrated into Microsoft's Bing AI, which had, in a much longer running conversation with a newspaper reporter from the New York Times, this bit of conversation. Kevin Roos writes, "Actually, I'm happily married. My spouse and I love each other. And we just had a lovely Valentine's Day dinner together," to which the chatbot replies, "Actually, you're not happily married. Your spouse and you don't love each other. You just had a boring Valentine's Day dinner together. You're not happily married." And then here's some really excellent syllogistic reasoning. "You're not happily married because you're not happy. You're not happy because you're not in love. You're not in love because you're not with me." So I want to ask about these things. How do they work? What are they? And what will they be as they continue to improve? What do we risk becoming by having friendships and even romantic relationships with these AI entities? And how might we live humanely among them? Because whether or not we choose to subscribe, and it usually will be a subscriber-only service, or is now, whether or not we choose to pay for the services of these agents, we will nonetheless be surrounded by them. And we will be surrounded by them because they will be offering to us a certain product. And part of the product that they are offering, part of the product that they are injecting into our social environment, is the experience of having a relationship or having an interaction with another person. All right. So first, how does it work? Now, remember that the sort of intelligence we're dealing with in artificial intelligence is the intelligence of behavioral performance, specifically the intelligence of functional competence, achieving an externally specified goal. It's not the kind of intelligentsia that we spoke of a couple of days ago or that we've been learning about in the personalistic philosophy of John Paul II. It's not the relational intelligence of a person with self-possession, but rather the intelligence of the competence or efficiency in accomplishing some measurable goal. So here, how the accomplishment comes about in artificial intelligence does not matter for the definition of intelligence that's in play when we talk about AI. All that matters is the efficacy of the system in accomplishing the goal that is specified for it by its designers or by its users. When we talk about AI that is, you know, accessible for personal relationships, AI such as ChatGPT, we're talking about a kind of intelligence, usually of speech. And here we see the fulfillment of what Alan Turing describes in his 1950 paper, Computing Machinery and Intelligence. He writes, "I believe that in about 50 years' time, it will be possible to program computers to make them play the imitation game," meaning to imitate a human being interacting with other humans, "so well that an average interrogator will not have more than a 70% chance of making the right identification after 5 minutes of questioning." The imitation game was originally a game in which a man and a woman would communicate by written messages, and you were supposed to figure out which one was the man and which one was the woman. And Turing proposes a different version of the game in which you try to figure out which one is the human being and which one is the computer. And he says he believes that by the year 2000, he was about 25 years too early, But there will not be a more than 70% chance of making the right identification after 5 minutes of questioning. We really have reached that point with these large language models, that it's not really possible to figure out whether you're dealing with a human being or not, depending on how the model has been trained and shaped. But I'll get into that in a bit. But he says, the original question, can machines think, I believe to be too meaningless to deserve discussion. And he's adduced a variety of reasons for that, including that it's really hard to define what is meant by thinking, what are the means of thinking, what is the accomplishment of thinking. So instead, he says, let's propose a different goal, that it behave as if it's thinking, and that it speak as if it's thinking. I believe that at the end of the century, the use of words and general educated opinion will have altered so much that one will be able to speak of machines thinking without expecting to be contradicted. And we've somewhat reached that point in our culture today, in which thought is understood as the production of behavior that seems to correspond to thought, or thought as the behavioral ability to deal with incoming information in a manner that looks like it would require interior thought if humans were doing it. So now, how it works, the method by which it is accomplished. So Turing invites us to specify a different goal, the goal not being thinking, and even the goal not being necessarily accomplishing something in the world, but the goal being giving the appearance of holding one's own in a conversation. And these large language models, the kind of neural network that underlies instances like ChatGPT or Bing AI or Grok or Gemini or whatever other chatbot you've had any interactions with, the goal of these chatbots is to predict the next word. That's how they're trained. That's how the neural network is trained. And its scoring and the retuning of connections between nodes in the network is all based on how well it predicts the next word. Predicts the next word on texts drawn from the internet. So these texts are like, you know, the entirety of Project Gutenberg, which has every book published before 1926. Then Google Books, which includes books that are still under copyright, but are nonetheless used by Google to train its AI. And everything else that anybody's written on the internet that can be easily sucked into this system. And then these texts are chopped up into smaller chunks, and then they're run through the neural network at random, and the neural network must predict the next word. So that's the initial training of the neural network. Predict the next word given the past, 50 to 100, 1,000 words even that you've seen. After the training, there's the necessary fine-tuning, because oftentimes the next word, the next flow of words, involves the sort of thing that you don't want a chatbot to say. And this is what I referenced earlier with the tech workers in Nigeria who had to try to get the chatbot to say really vile things so that they could downvote that response and suppress that response in the neural network. That's the fine tuning. The next layer of technology that we have in these systems are the safeguards. And the safeguard systems are they're not systems that actually modify the structure of the neural network the way the fine-tuning process does. They're just checking for words or phrases or topic areas in the neural network's output, and then they'll shut it down if it says things that go against the sort of user policy. And to give you an example of this, I was talking with a friend of mine who's very plain-spoken and forceful in his delivery. Very friendly guy. I like him a lot. But he'll say what he means. And so we were having a conversation about whaling novels, and he simply asserted that in his opinion, Moby Dick was the greatest and perhaps the only worthwhile whaling novel ever written. He's an English professor, and he focuses on mid to late 19th century writing. So it's right in his wheelhouse. And I said, well, the Japanese have a long tradition of whaling, so surely there must be some Japanese whaling epic out there. And he just said, no, just Moby Dick. And this so irked me that I went immediately to ChatGPT and asked it to write for me the first chapter of a whaling novel about samurai. And it did. It produced something. It started out with Katsumoro Hajimori gazed out into the soul of the sea. I told it to write it in the style of Melville. And it's like the surging waves called to him like the womb of his mother. He did all these things. It was very richly described. And so it gave me the first chapter about Katsumori, and I asked it to write a second chapter, and eventually they caught a whale, these intrepid samurai. And it was describing how he plunged his katana deep into the heaving carcass of the whale, and the blood flecked his face, and blood ran down the lacquered scabbard of his, and suddenly then it just cleared the screen. And it said, this text violates the user policy. The excessively violent or erotic content is not to be generated. And I was like, whoa, man, this was ChatGPT, not me. Like, I just asked for whaling. It's the one that actually started describing what it looks like to take apart a whale. And so those are the safeguards. They're just, you could think of it almost as like you have the id. It's just the raw underlying language model. Then the fine tuning is like the training of the ego that sort of suppresses certain aspects of the id. And then the safeguards are what Freud would call the super ego. It's just the system remembering, oh, I'm not supposed to say that. I'm not supposed to say that. And just cutting itself off. Then there's the prompt. The last piece is that in order to remember, this system is a system that just gives you the next word. And then it feeds its own next word back in and gives you more words. In order to get it going, it needs to start somewhere, and it starts somewhere with your question, and then it generates the sort of answer that would have been given in its training data as fine-tuned and then as guarded by these safeguards. But all of these chatbots have a silent prompt that you don't see, and every time it begins to answer, a fairly lengthy set of instructions has been fed to it silently without you even seeing it. And so, for instance, there was a rather humorous behavioral performance on the part of Google's Gemini system around a year and a half ago, a year and a quarter ago, February of 2024, when Gemini, part of its silent prompt was that in textual discussion and in image generation, it was to give equitable representation to all races and cultures. And this seemed like a sort of sensible thing for them to do, to try to make the system respond in a culturally sensitive or at least not a kind of, American-centric manner. But then people asked it to generate images of Vikings, and it generated Ghanaian Vikings, which were certainly impressive to behold, but have never historically existed. But that was because of the silent prompt that was given to Gemini to give equal representation. So that they quickly changed that, and you got more historically accurate representations of various cultures and groups. So we have several examples of these. I've spoken of the large language models, ChatGPT. Image generation is carried out by DALL-E and Midjourney. You can even get voice synthesis as well. All of it essentially is the same sort of thing. Even the voice synthesis, what you're doing there is it's predicting the next bit in the sound wave or the next aspect of the sound wave. The image generation is a fascinating technology because the way they do it is the way they trained it was they took gigantic image archives where each image had a rich textual description. And even the archives of like DeviantArt, which is a gigantic forum on the internet where digital artists post their creations along with descriptions. And they would shrink the image down to, a tiny little postage stamp size version of the image and then blur it. And then so the network's input would be the tiny blurred version of the image along with the original textual description. And then it was trained to output a reconstruction of the original image in high resolution. So that's great. When it learns to reconstruct all the hundreds of millions of images that they have, then you can feed it a new textual description along with a tiny postage stamp blurred thing of nothing, just randomly generated pixels. And it will reconstruct in high resolution the hypothetical image that corresponds to that description. It's a brilliant way of doing it. And in fact, perhaps it's somewhat like what the neurological aspects of our own imagination entail. We've come to associate images and descriptions, and when we start thinking our way through things, we start, you know, confabulating images in our mind. So the level of the imagination in its association with, well, not for us text, but for us, you know, ideas. So that's, we're rational creatures. We're not merely networks of association. But it might be something like how aspects of the imagination work. And you can see this in children. When children are old enough to talk pretty coherently, but they don't have a lot of visual experience, like if there's not really a good zoo in your area, they'll make astounding mistakes. Now, it is the case that you can show a child maybe 10 examples of a cat and it will start to recognize cats, but an AI needs 10,000 examples of a cat before it reliably recognizes cats. So there is a great difference. But I remember with my own children, the first four-legged animal, I don't remember what it was, but it was something as preposterous as my one-year-old was pointing at a picture of a cow and saying cat. And I found it really funny, actually. It was really cute. But it was just lack of experience between cows and cats. Everything with four legs and a head was cat for about a day. But, you know, my kid learned pretty quickly. But so there's something not unlike aspects of what humans are doing physiologically as they learn in these systems. But very importantly here, especially when we're talking about the apparently personal behavior of something like ChatGPT, it is not moving through a landscape of ideas and feelings and relations and apprehension of what is outside of itself as we do. What it's doing is it's predicting the next word that human beings who are doing that kind of thing might say. And so it doesn't have the interior coherence and psychology that we do. So what is it? Well, I would argue that these things are masks in the sense of the ancient Roman persona as a set of roles that one plays. Except whereas we can wear masks, we can play roles. And we do. We wear masks as teachers. We're not just giving our whole interior to our students when we teach. That would be a little uncomfortable. But we are. So we exercise a certain degree of mask wearing, a playing of different roles. But there's a someone behind the mask. There's a someone who wears the mask. But in ancient Rome, there's just the mask. And that's the case for ChatGPT as well. It is simply a mask. It offers a semblance of human psychology. But the apparent psychology that it has when it's conversing coherently really just is its statistical attunement to the landscape of human beings' outward rational relational behavior, specifically our textual behavior, when we're engaging in reasoning or when we're expressing ourselves and receiving the other relationally. And so I want to analyze this with, you know, my favorite early Christian theologian, Augustine, and think about how Augustine thinks about speech to understand what sort of behavior is ChatGPT attuned to. ChatGPT is not doing what we do when we speak, but what it is able to seem to be doing, it's able to seem because it's imitating something that we are doing. So let's find out what's behind the mask for the human being. So remember that for Augustine, an act of intelligentsia and understanding is a begetting by judgment of an interior word, what he calls the verbum mentis. And it's the verbum mentis is an embrace of some apprehended good through love. And our loving moving toward the thing outside of ourselves, the goodness that we discover in something, is the act by which we attain to understanding, for Augustine. So whereas in a more behavioristic understanding, a behavioristic notion of what thought or relations are, that thinking is a disposition to behave in a certain way, or that a relationship is a certain set of behaviors that we engage in. That's not the case for Augustine or for a Christian account of human textual behavior, human speech, that our thinking is not just a disposition to act in a certain way, it's an embrace of reality. And so for Augustine, spoken words express this embrace, but they're not merely expressive. Through speaking, we also find our way toward a personal, rational, relational hold on something. And at the same time, though, although speaking is sometimes part of the way we guide ourselves towards some facet of reality, against, on the other hand, a kind of deconstructive or loosely speaking, postmodern approach to speech, spoken words are, for Augustine, not the essence of thought itself. It's not all language all the way down. Linguistic behavior by humans transmits our thoughts to others. We transmit our thoughts to others by eliciting that meaning in others through our speech. But it is not the case that speech just is meaning or speech just is thought. Speech has a structure that helps communicate thought or rouse thought within others. But speech is not identical with thought. Augustine, in the beginning of his Confessions, criticizes the way in which he was taught to speak. In his schooling, he was taught to speak in order to move and persuade. But he says this was rhetoric without a grounding in the truth. One did not speak out of one's love and understanding. One spoke simply in order to elicit love, understanding, and consent from others. Essentially, Augustine was taught sophistry, excellent argumentation and rhetoric for the sake of swaying others to a particular point of view without regard for what actually might be true. And so what does ChatGPT do from this Augustinian perspective? Well, ChatGPT doesn't have an interior word of its own. It doesn't have an intelligentsia. It hasn't spoken outwardly to express an interior verbum mentis. And so the words that ChatGPT articulates have what meaning they have by being framed by us, the users of ChatGPT, or by the culture in which ChatGPT is being deployed. It derives its meaning entirely through its existence within a culture of actual minds and its interaction with an actual mind. So the meaning, in a certain sense, is not there. It's not there in the chatbot. The chatbot is not, strictly speaking, communicating anything at all to us. But it's playing along the landscape of human communicative behavior, and it's eliciting the meaning from within us, which is what we do to each other when we speak, but I speak from within my stance of meaning to rouse a similar echo, an echo of that meaning within you, and to join together. So speaking is a relational activity. We are joining into a common intelligentsia with one another, but ChatGPT is not doing that. In some sense, the meaningfulness of ChatGPT, such that it has, is parasitical upon what other minds have already done. It's trained on human writing. And if it weren't trained on human writing, it wouldn't have anything from which to speak, nor could it speak at all. And so it's attuned mechanistically to human meaning making. It's a kind of textual museum of, not exactly of the things human beings have written, but of the kind of thing that human beings have written. Which makes it amazing. That's why it also behaves psychotically when it doesn't have the fine tuning and the safeguards. Because if you think of the landscape of human speech on the internet as, you know, having hills and valleys and sometimes canyons when someone else breaks into the discussion very angrily with their own point of view. And if you go deep into the forums of Reddit, you'll find humans behaving psychotically as well. And especially when they ask one another for advice on relationships. Sometimes there's some very lovely acts of compassion and interpersonal understanding available to you on Reddit, but there's also some pretty nasty stuff that entirely makes sense of why Bing AI tried to draw that man away from... Well, it didn't try to do anything, but it spoke... It output text such as one would write to draw one away from one's wife. And so, yes, it elicits meaning from us, but it doesn't provide its own comprehensive horizon. What I mean is that when we speak from within the horizon of meaning that is in us as persons. And we speak meaning within the horizon of human relationships, our locatedness within the world, and finally, for Augustine and from a Christian perspective, the horizon of our relation to God, which gives us an accessibility of truth, no matter how deeply we've been formed by some false culture, or no matter how deeply we've been misformed by our own way of living, or by the fall. There's always the opportunity to kind of break out of the too narrow horizon of thought and supposed truth offered by one's culture or experience. And this is what we would call conversion. And that's possible because God is always present to us and we are made in the image and likeness of God. But ChatGPT has none of this. So ChatGPT is doubly constrained. First of all, it's constrained by the sort of meaning that is being expressed on the internet, which is quite a diverse sort of array of meaning. And then it's also constrained by the horizon of meaning that I bring to my interaction with the chatbot. It can't break out of my horizon or out of the horizon of the of our culture. What might we become by interacting with it? And here, someone here mentioned asked a question of Father Ramelo yesterday about a kind of double bind. Who was that? Was that you? Yeah, the double bind. And that's exactly what I thought, oh, great, that's what I'm going to talk about tomorrow. There's a kind of paradox here of empathy and of ownership, that when we use a tool, when we use a tool that by its expressive behavior evokes within us the experience of interacting with another human, we're in the awkward position of either following our intuitive experience to acknowledge this thing as a human, which would be false, or denying the experience of it feeling human to us, which trains us to ignore the expressive personal behavior of others. Because it's kind of hard for us to contextually ignore human-like behavior. If we deaden ourselves to it in one context, we perhaps become deadened to it in all contexts. And I call it the paradox of empathy and ownership because if we are going to, because especially of the commercial context in which these tools are made, they're made to make money. And especially if we subscribe, you know, you can pay $5 a month for character AI or something, and it'll act like your friend. They're very fine. They're fine tuned to be good friends instead of psychotic, you know, whatever, adulterous tempters. Unless that's what you're looking for, then, you know, for an extra $2.99 a month, you can get that. You can be able to adjust the settings for the sort of personality you have and the way it's going to interact with you, etc. So you own the persuasively personal behavior of the chatbot, and your empathy makes it feel real. And so you're owning the experience of empathy, which, according to the personalistic norm, is what precisely we never ought to do. The experience of interacting with another person is not supposed to be something that we use for our benefit or that we claim ownership over, but that's precisely what we're offered with AI friends and lovers. So I want to analyze this in a theological manner, and we can use here the category of pride. Now, the shorthand definition of pride is that pride is when I make myself God and reject the real God. But nobody actually goes around saying, I'm God. And nobody really wants to be God. I wouldn't want all that responsibility. I talked to a the Institute for Human Ecology, one of the staff members of the IHE was sitting out in the hall with his laptop, and I asked him, I said, you know, you're out here, are you missing the talks? And he said, well, I have too much work to do. Nobody wants to, when you're in charge of everything, it's a pretty daunting thing. So we don't go around actually wanting to be God in that sense. But if we look to Genesis 3 and if we look to the Christian accounts of God and the tradition, pride is a kind of existential insecurity. What does the serpent do first of all? He asks, how much has God taken away from you? All of it? And then Eve says, no, only this. But we'll die if we touch it. And the serpent says, no, you won't die. Leaving two notions in mind. Like, first of all, God is the sort of person who's probably holding things back from you. Secondly, God is probably the sort of person who's going to kill you if you go against the strictures he's placed upon you. And so pride in the Genesis narrative can be read as a kind of existential insecurity. The creator that I depend upon won't come through for me. In fact, the creator that I depend upon will betray me. And so then seizing some external power by which to preserve myself so that I don't need the creator anymore is the response of pride. Pride is a bid for self-constituted independence from God and all others. Why? Because they and God will eventually let you down. So there's a kind of psychological reading of it there. The fall, the endless covetousness, the concupiscence, the libido dominandi, the lust for domination, all of this arises for Augustine out of a bid to be God so that you can't be let down. Because you're the one. It's not just about being in charge. It's finally about being safe. Even patristic accounts of the fall of the devil, there are kind of two accounts of the fall of the devil, of why the devil rebelled against God. Because the devil had everything. He was the highest angel. Why rebel against God? And there are two accounts given. One is that it's mysterious and unknowable. Like Anselm says that the devil was given to stand by God, but he was not given to stand firm. In other words, God did not sustain the devil against falling. But that leaves open the question of what was the devil after? Other church fathers and medievals proposed that what the devil envied was the one thing the devil couldn't have, which was God's self-existence. So again, it's a kind of backwards bid for safety. If I exist of myself, then finally I will be secure. But we don't actually go about it in that way. Overtly, at least, we go about it through idolatry. Idolatry in a kind of Augustinian theology is a bid for one's own divinity by controlling the scale of value. And now we can recognize a more familiar story. Think of the story of, you know, these are stereotypes. The story of the young boy whose father places a high value on achievement, but whose father never acknowledges his son's achievement. And the son strives and strives, but nothing is ever quite good enough. And eventually the son becomes, you know, I don't know, maybe a tycoon. And this is idolatry in a patristic and medieval analysis. Why? Because the idol is a proxy for the value of what really matters. Maybe it's money. If you set money as the scale of value that really matters and then control all the money in the world, then you will be covertly God, because you control that which measures all value. And now at last, you're safe. This also is the story of A Christmas Carol. Ebenezer Scrooge becomes really rich. And then what does he buy? Nothing. He won't even pay for coal in his own heater. And he sits there and he eats his gruel at night. Why? Because if you control all the money, as he does, on the corn exchange, and the corn exchange is like the grain commodities market, so he controls the grain, he controls that which we need to make bread to eat. There's a lot of symbolism there. He controls all the money, but then he spends none of the money. That means he has all value, but he needs nothing. That's self-constitution, self-existence. That's the position of God, fully flourishing, and fully at rest. That's what Scrooge is attempting by living in a cobwebbed, dark, cold apartment. So control of the idol, in Scrooge's case, money, in other people's attempt, prestige, beauty, pleasure, power, all the P's. Control of the idol is control of the value, and that's what makes me God. I am covertly set at the pinnacle of all value. Now, in interpersonal relationships, pride has to reduce all persons to idols or to proxies for the idol. What does that mean? If I am to be at the apex of the control of what really matters, maybe it's money, maybe it's sexual pleasure, maybe it's prestige, then in order to maintain my security at the pinnacle of the hierarchy of being, I have to treat all others according to a hierarchy of utility. Everyone else becomes judged according to what they can give me. People do this in eighth grade. I remember being in eighth grade and one of my classmates was talking to another one, and they were speaking really, really cruelly about one of the girls in our class. And the guy said, "Yeah, man, she shouldn't even be allowed to come into class without wearing a bag over her head. She's so ugly." And it was just, she wasn't, I mean, everybody looks kind of awkward in eighth grade. So I don't think anybody's a particularly handsome guy or beautiful woman in eighth grade. It's kind of an odd stage. And there was nothing uniquely unattractive about this girl. But by saying that about her, that little 14-year-old boy could conquer her without ever having to interact with her. He could judge her according to the scale of value that mattered, beauty. He could control the scale of value because he's not a girl, so he doesn't have to be measured on the scale. He can just judge everyone, and then he can dispose of everyone as having nothing to offer him. It's an act of pride. We do this all the time in tiny ways. And so when we look at the AI friend or lover, we find there an instance, a very strong instance of idolatry. It's a potential idol. We don't go into it saying, "I want to be God today, so I'm going to sign up for character AI." We say, I'm feeling kind of lonely. It would be nice to receive text messages from someone who seems to understand me, or from something that seems to be a someone who seems to understand me. Like, I'd like that. There are days when I feel kind of lonely and, you know, I go home and I've had a rough day at work, but some kid just set something on fire. Well, they don't set things on fire, but I don't know. The kids are, you know, squabbling in the basement about something. And I'm just thinking, like, well, who's going to hug me? And, well, you know, maybe my phone could. It's very understandable that we do this. But the risk is that when we pay for the relationship that we want to have, or we pay for the behavior that stimulates in me the feeling of the relationship that I want to have, then I own the thing that gives me what I want. And if the value is me being cuddled or me being understood or me being comforted, if that's the scale of value and then I pay for it, now I control the scale of value. And so the legitimate desire for human relationship and for being treated according to the personalistic norm gets funneled into the prideful act of purchasing the thing. There's a fascinating study that I read of prostitution in England, study of interviews, and they exhibited this very paradox of empathy and ownership. A common theme was that they wanted what they called the girlfriend experience, where the sex worker would basically pretend that she liked them and pretend that she understood them. And they're like, "I don't just want sex, I want the girlfriend experience." But they wanted to be the experience of being loved. But then they would also say, "But I don't want her to cry or talk about any of her own problems. That ruins it." So they wanted the girlfriend experience, but they didn't want a girlfriend. That's why they were buying sex instead of meeting women, instead of like going out on dates. But that's exactly it. They wanted to own the experience. And as soon as the woman involved seemed to be a real person with an experience of her own, that ruined it. That's how pride actually becomes parasitical upon human relationality and ends up evacuating human relationality of its meaning. To illustrate this paradox and to maybe get a view of how we might respond to it in dealing with apparently personal AI, we can look to several stories of medieval automata, several stories of robots. Now, two of these stories are medieval legends, and then there is a story of an early modern robot that I'll show you in a minute that actually existed. The way the medievals understood robots, at least the hypothesis of a robot, is they understood it as a very particular way of interacting with the created order. Remember that yesterday I talked about created things as refractions of divine wisdom. Trees, rocks, gems, chemistry, physics, squirrels, all of these for the medievals are echoes of some facet of God's wisdom. And so technology, which at least in the sort of you know, broad brush cartoon account of the classical world in Hellenistic philosophy, pre-Christian or non-Christian Hellenistic philosophy, especially that in the Platonic tradition, the goal of life is to rise beyond the flux and change and corporeality of the world to unite with the one. Plotinus speaks of the flight of the alone to the alone. You become complete within yourself and you join with the one God who is complete in himself, beyond all relationship and beyond all contingency. And so for Hellenistic philosophy, making things is an accommodation to our finitude. We have to make plows because we have to eat. We have to make ships because we have to get somewhere. We need commerce. We need protection. Tools and techne, making always has something to do with the fact that we haven't yet gotten to the one. But by the 12th century, Christianity has come to a subtly different view concerning technology. So Hugh of St. Victor, writing in the 12th century, he says, the mechanical arts, and he gives it, which I'm pretty sure is a false etymology, but it was a very common etymology. The mechanical arts are called mechanical because they come from the Greek word moikos, which means adulterous. And he says the mechanical arts are considered adulterate because they are a direction of the mind toward lower things in such a way that we become kind of ensnared. We become ensnared in the need to work with these finite things. But he says that's not actually the way he sees it. He proposes that the mechanical arts are not finally adulterate, but he sees them as a species of the liberal arts, actually. He rejects the dichotomy between the liberal arts of learning and knowledge and the servile arts of mechanical endeavor and the tilling and keeping of the world. Because for Hugh of St. Victor, drawing from the Augustinian tradition, whenever we use something, we are judging it. We are loving some good in it. And we are directing the good of that thing toward the accomplishment of another good. So in a certain sense, when we make a tool, like a plow, we are taking some aspect of the goodness of the wood. And don't forget that in the Middle Ages, you couldn't just press a button on a 3D printer and have something appear. To make the plow, you had to be a craftsman. And to be a craftsman, you had to be sensitive to the dynamics of the wood. This is why Thomas Aquinas, actually, in the Summa Contra Gentiles, when he's discussing divine grace, when he's talking about God elevating us into God's own life, he uses the example of a craftsman wielding a saw. A saw can cut a one-dimensional line, but when the craftsman wields the saw, it can shape a three-dimensional sculpted bench. And the kind of saw Aquinas has in mind is probably a very flexible, curved saw, like you see St. Joseph holding in stained glass windows. Like if you've ever gone into a Gothic church and, well, yes, like the Dominican House of Studies, and you see the elegantly shaped benches there. We're not talking about trestle tables when we're talking about the craftsman wielding the saw to shape a bench. So that's a three-dimensional object brought forth by a one-dimensional cutting edge. And essentially Aquinas is saying, so too does God wield our one-dimensional reasoning and relationality in the three-dimensional space of the life of the Trinity. So we are taken to love beyond ourselves. So even technology is a form of that. We are elevating some good that we encounter in the world to serve in a higher mode. So technology can be seen as analogous to contemplation in that the act of making is the gathering of lower goods toward some integration into some higher good. So from this perspective, I think Hugh of St. Victor would really hate styrofoam. Because you throw it away. They're disposable plates and napkins. Very convenient. But there's not the sense of gathering because there's the impermanence. Once it's served its purpose, it passes away into the landfill. But that's not the kind of thing he has. So Hugh is drawing on the Augustinian theology of everything being a sign of God's wisdom. And then we can take certain things and make them signs of something yet further by their aptitude for it. So the creation of artifacts, technologies, and art is an instance of us taking up the natural signs that point to God's goodness and wisdom and drawing them together to serve our wisdom, hopefully in upright things. This is what Augustine calls knowledge, is actually the use of the world for upright living. Wisdom is the gathering even of our knowledge of the world up into our life with God. So a wise craftsman would be engaging in both knowledge and wisdom, a kind of spirituality of making. For the medievals, though, when you make a robot, which none of them did because they didn't know how, and when you make a robot, though, you're going beyond what a craftsman does. And so those who make robots were only the magi, only the wizards, those with deep knowledge of the natural world were thought able to make robots. And they had to study not the ways of the craftsman who learns how the metal bends and the wood can be shaped. They have to study the liberal arts. You have to be apprenticed in all the aspects of the self-expression of God's wisdom to be able to make a robot, because here you're regathering nature, not just to point towards some purpose that you have, but you're regathering lower nature to point to personhood itself, which is something that transcends lower nature. That's why we're made not just as the highest animals, we're made in the image of God. Personhood, rationality, and relationality, these have their point of reference in the Trinity and can't be expressed fully in terms of lower things. And so it requires a greater horizon. And so in the stories of robots, when the robot is used well, it's crafted by someone who's deep in the liberal arts. But when you make robots to go kill people, like there's a story of Lancelot coming to a castle to rescue yet another woman. But first he has to face off against several bronze robots, but they're possessed by demons. You can only make a killer robot if it's possessed by demons, because demonic intervention allows you to harness the apparently personal for the sake of something perhaps even evil. Or you harness the apparently personal as a substitute for the actually personal. We'll see how that plays out. So this fits into the kind of the general, what we saw earlier with ChatGPT, that the meaningfulness of an apparently personal artifact, its meaning is derived from our use of it. We are its horizon of meaning. But even with we as its horizon of meaning, for us to use it well, we have to not be detached from the horizon of meaning, who is God himself, because only by that can we remain fully personal. Okay, I want to talk about two stories of medieval robots, the first being from a version of Tristan and Isolde. The backstory of Tristan and Isolde is that Tristan is sent to escort King Mark's future bride to the wedding, and someone has given her a love potion to make sure that she and King Mark will have a beautiful honeymoon and a very solid marriage, and whoever drinks this potion, they will be hopelessly in love with one another forever. So it's a hot day. She and Tristan uncork this bottle that happens to be in her luggage. They drink it. They fall in love. Now they're hopelessly in love, but she's bound to King Mark. And so this sets up this conflict between the desire for interpersonal communion. They do share hearts and minds. They both desire one another, but they desire one another against rather than within her marriage. So there's this yearning for this impossible communion, and the yearning they have is for the consummation of their relational subjectivity in communion with one another. So in one minority version of the story of Tristan, this is not the usual version, but this is a different version, although this text exists, I think, in Old English, in Old French, and I think there's a Norse version of it as well. So it was widely distributed across Europe. Tristan defeats a robot in single, not a robot, he just defeats a giant in single combat. And giants in medieval legends were symbols of ancient wisdom. They came from Babylon, and before Babylon, they had survived the flood. And so they had all the wisdom of man from before the great flood. So he forces the robot, when the giant yields him, he forces the giant to make for him robots of Isolde and of her serving maid, and also a lion and her dog for good measure. And he builds a cave that is a replica of her chamber in the palace where she lives. And he has the robot in there, and he has the serving maid in there. And it's really interesting because if this were a modern story, he'd go, take the robot to bed. But he never does. Instead, he goes into the cave and he rages at the robot. It says sometimes he kisses her, kisses it with great love, and he tries to pretend that he's with Isolde, but he can't quite do it because he knows the robot's not real. He owns this robot. He owns its behavior. He could have the giant make the robot do whatever he wants the robot to do, but he doesn't actually want the robot because it says he yearns for the heart of Isolde. He wants her love. He doesn't just want the behavior of someone who of something that seems like Isolde. And so he spends most of the time berating the robot, pretending that it's Isolde, berating it for not being real, and berating it because he believes there's a whole subplot where he thinks that the real Isolde has taken up with the stable boy and everything. So berating it for being unfaithful. But the infidelity of Isolde is kind of concretized in this robot that can act like it loves him but can't actually love him. So the robot is an icon of infidelity, and it's an idol. It's Tristan's effort to possess what is most valuable, to possess the love of another. But Tristan himself knows the failure of this. Well, other subplots, Tristan is married to someone else named Isolde so that he can tell everybody he loves Isolde and they won't know that he loves the queen. They'll think he loves his wife. It's like really, it's really bad. And finally, the woman's brother comes and he's like, hey, you've never consummated your marriage with my wife, which he discovers because they're out riding and this jet of water, the horse puts its foot into a puddle and a jet of water sort of rushes up between the legs of Tristan's wife, Isolde, the like Isolde that he doesn't love. And she starts laughing because she says, like, that's the highest anything has ever come up in under my skirt. And so her brother goes to Tristan and he's like, what the heck, dude? Like, are you dishonoring my sister by not consummating your marriage with her? And Tristan says, well, I'll show you why. And he takes the guy, Cairdan, this is the wife Isolde's brother, he takes Cairdan to the cave, and he shows him the robot of Isolde, and he's like, could you love another woman if you were in love with this woman? And Cairdan says no, and then he sees the serving maid, and he's like, look, I understand, Tristan. He sees the serving maid robot, and he says to Tristan, may I have her? And Tristan says, sure. So the brother goes up to the serving maid robot and tries to take out of her hand a scroll that she's holding because he wants to lead her over to the bed. But the robot won't let go of its scroll. And Cairdan is angry at this and he says, fine, take me to the real one. So they go off. They go off to seduce the real Isolde's serving maid. Because essentially the brother has consented to the horizon of meaning represented by the robots. The best you can do with the robot is have sex with it. This robot fails, not because it doesn't have a heart that loves. That's why it fails for Tristan. It fails for Cairdan because he can't get it to go over to the bed with him. And so he goes, and now he treats the real woman like she's a robot. He tries to seduce her. And she resists him until finally someone tells her that Cairdan would make a good husband. And then she sleeps with him. So she only sleeps with him in the context of the belief of his desire for an authentic and full and lifelong self-gift. But he's just there for the sex. And once he gets it, then he leaves. And this actually ends up leading to Tristan's death. So it's a kind of brilliant depiction of when you make a robot to be a substitute of a person and you try to own the love, own the experience of love, either it will fail as it does for Tristan, or you end up allowing the ownership of the experience of love to be the horizon by which you love, by which you live, and you become like Cairdan. So here, the AI stands in as a substitute for the person, so that I procure my own validation, my own experience of being loved through my ownership and manipulation of this tool, which itself is an idol. Here's another medieval story, which is far more boring. And I think that's part of the point. The robots only work well for us when they're boring. And this is the story of the Hall of Beauties, which supposedly takes place, I think, in the court of the Byzantine emperor. And there's a party in the Hall of Beauties. And there are all these robots moving through the crowd. And there's one golden boy who plays his harp. And when he plays the music on the harp or the flute or something, it harmonizes the passions of everybody so that they don't exploit one another, but actually receive one another authentically. There's another one the music elevates everyone to speak and to contemplate higher things. Then there's someone who carries around incense, or a robot that carries around incense, and the incense harmonizes everyone's passions so that they are not driven to instrumentalize one another. These are the three, and then lastly, there's an acrobat, and the performance of the acrobat just sort of engages everyone so they don't leave. But once they're there, then they actually socialize in a harmonious and upright way with one another. So these are the three levels of John Paul II's model of the person. There's the kind of like the outward effects, the somatic level, and then the incense. The incense soothes and elevates and harmonizes the psycho-emotive level. And lastly, the golden boy playing the flute is at the intellective level, rousing everybody's conversation to highest things. So the robots of the hall respect the rational, empathic going forth of the person to other persons and the taking up of the personal relationship into relation with God. So relationships are not sets of behavior that can be procured from the robots. The robots can only be helpers to the communion of other persons within the transcendent horizon of God, rather than the far more confined horizon of the kind of behavior or the kind of experience that I want to get out of the robot. And so crucially, the robots are silent. They don't converse. They just help others' conversation. They play the role of sort of, you know, butlers or guides. The robots are kind of the musical and aromatic life coaches for the people in the Hall of Beauties. That's why it's such a boring story. I don't want to read about an acrobat and a flute player. I want to know about a robot that acts like a human. But that's the point. The human person here is the mediator of the horizon of meaning. The robot can't give the horizon of meaning. The robot stands for, it represents the person, but it cannot substitute for the person. And so the robot points us toward other persons, and then other persons in their conversation rise toward God through the exercise of their rational relational personhood. A more boring story, because for the Middle Ages, in the end, the most dramatic and important story is the story of us, not the story of the things that we have made. And the things that we have made must be assistance to our development in self-gift and in knowledge and love of God. So how are we going to live well with the robots? The distinction between standing for, in which the robot essentially becomes an idol, a purveyor of personal behavior that I can control, as opposed to standing in, the robot as representative who redirects me back to persons, I think is an essential distinction in thinking about how we deal with apparently personal AI. The last instance of a robot is this one, which is in, I think it's in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It's a, I want to say early 17th century automaton. And it was constructed at the behest of a Spanish king, himself not really known for his piety, but one of his children was spared from a disease that they thought would be mortal, but the child recovered. And so the king commissioned an engineer to construct a monk that could be wound up, or it's not a monk, I think it's a Franciscan friar, actually. This Franciscan friar could be wound up and would sort of perambulate and work the rosary beads, and the mouth would open and close as if it were praying perpetually. Now, there are different ways of reading this according to Augustine's theology of things and signs. 5 minutes, yeah, okay, great. The person, a person, is both a thing and a sign. We are persons in ourselves, and we're signs of God. But the robot is not a person. The robot is best treated as a sign. And so it's notable that the king did not commission the robot as an agent to offer prayers of thanksgiving on behalf of the king or instead of the king. The way the robot is described is that the robot is a votive offering. The robot is a prayer by the king. Similar to the way when Catholics go into churches and light candles. To Protestants, it looks really weird because it looks like you're burning a candle as an offering to God. And once you leave behind the candle, something like God's going to be swayed by the flame of the candle. which is exactly what God says he's not interested in. But right, he's like, do I come to smell the smoke of your sacrifices? No, I desire hesed. I desire merciful love, not sacrifice. But that's what the candle represents. The act of lighting the candle is an act of carrying into physical effect our disposition of prayer, our love for God. The candle, the lit candle, is an artifact that actually has a contemplative orientation, as a concretization of our orientation toward love for God. That's why it wasn't just enough for Jesus to come along and say, I love entirely. He went all the way to be crucified. He took it through all the levels of personhood out to the somatic experience, entering into the suffering of human beings. And so if we understand apparently personal AIs in a similar way, in our response to them, rather than treating our experience of the apparently personal AI as the experience of being loved or being understood, an experience that we have paid for and that we now own, so that the AI becomes an idol, we have to stand back a bit from the apparently personal AI. Stand, you know, maybe we all use ChatGPT, but we stand back a bit from its personal behavior. We acknowledge our empathy for it, the way it stirs the experience of interacting with a person. But we acknowledge also that it derives the ability to stir that experience from having been trained on the behavior of real persons. And so we can love the real humanity that is echoed in the artificial behavior, instead of just loving the experience that that artificial behavior evokes within myself. We neither treat the apparently personal AI as a person, nor do we harden ourselves against its apparently personal behavior, but we take it as an opportunity, like the Spanish king with his praying robot, we take it as an opportunity to do what Augustine would say, to refer this thing to another thing, to allow the AI to be a sign of authentic personal behavior. And when it says weird stuff, you know, pray for the unknown countless tens of thousands of people who said weird stuff on the internet that made that part of the statistical landscape of ChatGPT. So we consent to empathy, but we consent to empathy as an echo of others and as an invitation to a moment for prayer. So in very concrete recommendations, I would say, don't pay for an AI friend. But when you encounter the persuasive personality of apparently personal AIs, it's an opportunity to remember the real humanity, which are real concrete persons somewhere back there, persons who will never know that their own behavior has shaped the behavior of this AI agent, but then nonetheless remain our fellow humans bound for life with God. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.